Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Justin Ray, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show, I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bets.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Carson's Corner is brought to you by www.graythought.com. That is www.graythought.com. And onthemat.com. Please make sure to visit www.onthemat.com. Well, hello, folks. Welcome to the show. I'm Bob Carson. If you're wondering why there's a somber mood here in the studio, it's because we have just received the shocking news of the earlier death of Amy Winehouse. Well, it's not so shocking, and really, I don't feel very somber about it, to be honest with you. Don't get me wrong, I hate to see anyone die before their time, but there comes a certain point with drug and alcohol abuse where you have to accept whatever the consequences are of your behavior. And I'm not saying that it was her fault. Of course, as addiction is an illness, and God knows, I imagine it's hard to stop smoking crack, even if you can easily afford it and don't have anything to do on a Saturday afternoon. I'm certainly not trying to make light of this situation, but I'm sure we all see the usual sort of overwrought tributes and tasteless internet comments that accompany some of these events here. I think most of us had the feeling that this story's ending was guaranteed to be an unfortunate one that may come sooner rather than later. Okay. I want to express my condolences and support for the victims of the attack in Norway. For one person to kill 80 others in a shooting rampage is about as terrible as it gets, especially given the young age of almost all the victims. The shooter's motive is still unclear, although he appears to have some far right-wing views, and Norway has had a resurgence of extremist right-wing rhetoric in recent years. That's not to say that this death is linked to some of the rhetoric, but it's definitely something to examine. They had open race baiting there in recent elections. They had the neo-Nazi killings going back to the early parts of this decade in 2000 and beyond. So, I don't know. There was an infamous campaign poster that featured three white sheep kicking a black sheep out of Norway. I'm not joking, folks. There are some issues that the Norwegians are wrestling with right now, just like the rest of the world. Rest in peace to the victims. I hope that we can figure out what makes these violent incidents happen and address the cause directly in the future. Okay, let's go to the rest of the show. I felt like I had to mention some of the recent world events here. Here we are veering hard back towards the world of combat sports. I promise you're going to want to stick around or even skip fast forward about 30 seconds to hear our interview with MMA journalist Jason Probst. Jason is a longtime member of the MMA community and one of the best writers out there. He really doesn't rely on gimmicks and doesn't do one of those bad 1990 internet humor columns, you know the type, something that belongs on GeoCities pro wrestling sites. Probst is a different blend altogether, folks. This guy is one of the few legitimate journalists we have in MMA, and he's a contributor to ESPN, SureDog, and various publications because of that. Let's forget World Strife for a while by playing that interview with Jason Probst, Donnie. Here it is, folks. Here is part one of my interview with Jason Probst. Jason Probst is a freelance writer well known to fans for his frequent coverage of MMA events for entities such as ESPN and SureDog. Probst is also a visible and valued member of the sometimes chaotic and depressing underground forum. He's here to us. He's here with us today on Carson's Corner. How you doing, Jace?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
I need to warn you that it's my sworn duty to hit you with the tough questions that the fans of the underground and MMA want to know. I wanted to start out by discussing the area known as Yelm. Can you?
Classic. You're throwing the chin music right off the bat.
tell me, what makes your town of origin stand out?
Well, you know, Yelm, Washington has a lot going against it. It is one of the darkest spots in the lower continental 48 states. It's near Olympia, Washington. It's right on where all the clouds come in from the Pacific and the peninsula. So it's hopelessly, unceasingly, terribly dark. That's the first thing Yelm has going for it. Second thing is Yelm is home to one of the world's largest New Age cults, known as the Ramtha School of Enlightenment, which I was fortunate enough to be a member of as a teenager when my family relocated to Yelm. And they're into all sorts of everyday things like survivalism, alien abductions, purple invisible people that emerge from the earth. Had a few celebrity members, including Linda Evans and Philip Michael Thomas, the guy on Miami Vice. You'd see them in town now and then. So Yelm's just another happy slice of Americana with darkness, New Age weirdness. And it's the home of Dennis Hallman, one of the submission whizzes of the modern era. So Yelm has everything going for it.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like a place I would want to be, seriously.
Oh, no, it's a great place. I went back for my 20-year reunion last year, and, you know, they'd added a couple fast food restaurants, and there's still the old survival store kicking in town where you can buy, you know, dried foods to await the apocalypse. So, you know, they're just folks getting by.
So some people have called it the Camelot of Thurston County. Others have stated that the pin-faced guy from the movie Hellraiser lives there and works at a hardware store.
Yes, no, I've heard the Hellraiser allegations. I haven't been there enough to keep on top of it. But I think everything you need to know about Yelm, Washington is you know, you go through, sometimes you'll just see a kid standing on a corner just flipping everybody off at the main intersection.
Dennis Hallman, as you mentioned, of course, is from there. He's another famous Yelm boy. If we have Jason Probst, the intellectual, and Dennis Hallman, the tough one, who would make up the rest of the Yelm outsider gang?
There's a couple. I'm trying to think. Well, there was obviously Jay-Z Knight, the leader of the cult, the Ramtha school that's in Yelm. She's obviously the Yelm's sort of their Gordon Gekko, so to speak. The zillion properties, has tons of followers. There's a lot of interesting characters in Yelm, and it's, you know, for me, I lived there in high school and then went to college, and moved to California. Every time I go back there, just the grayness, you know, if you've never lived in the Pacific Northwest, it's the grayness, the overcast that really gets to you, and, does make for some hardy people. So, pretty much anybody you find in Yelm is gonna be pretty scrappy if they've lived there a long time.
Would you, for us, rate the performance of Yelm Mayor Ron Harding, which, by the way, sounds like the name of an adult performer?
Right. You know, is Ron Harding still the mayor of Yelm? I'm impressed. You've done your research. He was mayor when I was in high school. Right. Wow. He's kind of got like a Boss Tweed-like dynasty going there. You know, I would say he's doing a pretty good job. It's kind of become a commuter town for a lot of the state workers in Olympia because, you know, property's fairly cheap there.
Right. One MMA fighter who, speaking of adult performers, was nearly an adult performer, may still be in the future, is Mr. Dan Quinn, who I'm very good friends with. Dan is my personal lifestyle guru and weight loss counselor. Is it true that you're also a fan of Dan's video output and Stevie Enhanced Lifestyle?
Yes, and you know, it's very weird that you know Dan Quinn, because when I was working for my local newspaper here in California, Dan Quinn actually materialized one day in the lobby. And I think he had a fight coming up that he was either in or promoting, and he luckily didn't get past the receptionist, who was a real bulldog, because otherwise I would end up talking to him. And I wasn't ready, really, to accept Dan Quinn in my life at that point. You know, Dan Quinn is a paradigm shift. He is a seeker, a bringer of higher knowledge. And, you know, I can always sit back and really revel in what the man's been able to put together on his YouTube videos. Although I have to say that sometimes, you know, his videos do catch me a little off guard. You know, I mean, you never really know where Dan's going to go. And for the hardcore people in here in NorCal, I mean, a lot of us know who Dan Quinn is, and, you know, he definitely is an advocate of stevia. Now, did that stuff actually work for you? Did it help you lose weight?
Yes. I have lost over 30 pounds. You know, now I'm back in New Jersey. I was living with Dan for about 3 weeks or so, and I still continue to lose weight. My cardio output has increased. I'm running, you know, probably close to a 9-minute mile now, where I've never been able to run a mile period in years. I'm eating a lot. So I would say yes, and I've inspired other people here in New Jersey to take Stevie as well.
And, you know, has had some losses and isn't a big name to the people, you know, that don't know him. But, I guess Kimbo will always kind of have that sort of that sideshow effect, and Dan has a lot going on. I've kind of become a fan of bare knuckles, actually. You know, just kind of, you know, having been a long-time boxing writer and following it in the sport, you know, especially at the heavyweight level, it's just stagnated so badly that after seeing Vladimir Klitschko and David Haye wage that dreadful bout for 12 rounds, I almost wanted to, like, get on YouTube and just watch, like, Pikey street fight videos, you know, just to see somebody actually land a punch.
Well, boxing, is that how you became interested in the world of combat sports?
Yeah, I mean, I followed boxing readily from, you know, the tail end of Muhammad Ali's career in 1978. I was a huge fan of the sport. I mean, devoured every book, every fight, and started covering it in 97, eventually working for a site called Max Boxing, which is kind of the internet site. And then about 2001, I got in contact with some people at that time. There were a lot of good writers writing for Max Fighting at the time, Josh Gross, Tom Gerbasi, Joe Hall, a lot of good people, and just sort of kind of saw the demographic projections of both. And, you know, in the mid-2000s, I worked as a round-by-round scorer for ESPN on a couple fights, and while that was good, I just saw how MMA was, you know, really constantly offering up a better product, particularly on the pay-per-view cards, you know, whereas with boxing, you know, I'd pay $45, $50 bucks for, you know, a main event that might or not be good and an absolutely meaningless undercard. And I've always said, and I'll reiterate it here, that, you know, the inherent value of MMA is the undercard. You know, a lot of time maybe the main event isn't great, but there's so many meaningful bouts between valuable contenders and top guys that actually are competitive that, you know, people lay down their $50. You want to see some good fights, and boxing has just utterly failed to deliver that. You know, and I get a lot of hate mail from boxing fans that maybe don't know, you know, that I used to be a huge boxing fan and a boxing writer, and I've edited a historical boxing book, you know, by a friend of mine that's a, you know, well-known author and certainly love the sport, but its downhill is absolutely, downfall is absolutely undeniable. It's just become a crappy product, and MMA in many ways just kind of replaced that.
Were there any fights in particular that really captured your attention and made you a fan of the sport when it comes to boxing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, in the early 80s when you had, you know, great fighters like Carlos Zarate, Wilfredo Gomez, you know, the Hagler Hearns, Leonard Duran, Foursome, you know, obviously Mike Tyson. Even in the early 90s, you know, the emergence of, you know, great fighters like Pernell Whitaker, Julio Cesar Chavez, you know, it seemed there was always a storyline. And obviously, you know, I covered a couple great fights. I covered the first fight between Morales and Barrera, which is amazing to be there. So, you know, in person, and I've always said in person, a great boxing match really has no equal. It's just that I probably have to watch 100 of them to see one, whereas in MMA it's like, you know, happens regularly. So that's it.
Were you a fan of Mike Tyson in his era of dominance, like fellow MMA intellectual Lee, the Mastermind Murray?
You know, I was, and I've always believed that Mike Tyson really suffers from a lot of unfair analysis and assessment of his skills. You know, the Mike Tyson that emerged after, the February 10th, 1990 loss to Buster Douglas, and especially after he was sprung from jail, I think it was in March 95, you know, that is not Tyson at his best. You know, Tyson was a very good fighter, very talented. And a lot of people, you know, say Lennox Lewis in his prime wouldn't have beaten him. That is so false.
Right.
The difference between them is Mike Tyson got his head beat on for 10 rounds against Douglas. Holyfield beat on him. You know, he had to take a heck of a beating to go down. Lennox Lewis crumbled twice from Haseem Rahman and Oliver McCall. You know, Lennox Lewis never took a bad beating because he could never stay long enough to take one. So while he may have had the style to be the better fighter in their relative primes, to me it's just laughable how people, you know, they dismiss Tyson. I mean, yeah, he was a bit of a front runner. He had some limitations and could be frustrated, but, you know, you really had to put some leather on the guy to get rid of him. And to me it's just, you know, watching, you know, Vladimir Klitschko, who, you know, flinches as soon as you hit him solid, to me it's just laughable that he's the best heavyweight in the world.
That's a good point, is that the Klitschko brothers are I think, known for their unwillingness to really be in a fight. In fact, that David Haye fight, Klitschko, you know, I think even in the post-fight interview admitted that he was afraid of David Haye. He didn't want to get caught. He was just overly cautious, and that made for a bad fight. And then after that, you had David Haye blaming his toe, said, you know, he suffered a broken toe. And it's just, you know, it's really deteriorated the boxing scene. You're absolutely right about that. There's no American heavyweight boxers, at least that I'm aware of. And you know, there's many different reasons for that. But going back to Mike Tyson, I saw something interesting on your website where you asked if Mike Tyson's story was starting to resemble some Sonny Liston's.
Right, pretty interesting. Right.
Yeah.
No, yeah, and that's kind of the thing I always enjoyed, you know, taking a bit of a historical perspective, you know, because Sonny Liston, I mean, you know, he really was a lot older than people, you know, really knew he was when he won the title in, I think, 61 or 62 against Floyd Patterson. I mean, he may have been, you know, in his late 30s or close to 40. It was really in his prime in the mid to late 50s where he was just decimating the heavyweight division. And, you know, Mike Tyson had a lot of problems like Sonny Liston. You know, outside of the ring, he could never seem to get his public image right after a belief for flirtation with being a media darling when he won the title in 86. But, you know, there's a lot in common, and it's a very, you know, it's a recurring tale with boxers. You know, you don't get people that are talented boxers typically without coming from a certain segment of society that has its own challenges. And you know, Tyson ultimately fell prey to those, although it seems in recent years he's straightened out, he's substance-free, and he seems to kind of be living the placid life of an ex-champ. So I still root for him, you know, to do well.
Yeah, he sort of had a rebirth as a media figure, an entertainer, and if he sticks with it and stays away from drugs, I hope that this phase of his life will be a marked improvement from, you know, what we've seen from him in the past, you know?
No, absolutely. And it's like I said, you know, like, you know, when you look at the, you know, win or lose, Tyson drew people to want to watch him. That Klitschko-Haye fight, you know, I can't remember the last time a 12-round heavyweight fight happened and the winner averaged like two or three power punches landed around. I mean, it was that dreadful. It was like a four-hour soccer match, you know, with no goals. It was just, you know, and for all it was hyped to be, I guess, in the big ring entrances, it just was a further reminder of me of, like, this is exactly why I left this sport for MMA.
Yeah, some people still talk excitedly about him coming back to the ring for various freak show fights. I personally would hate for that to happen because Mike has said himself that he doesn't want to fight anymore and only, you know, he would only consider fighting when he has to for money. To see him come back would just be sad and probably would undo whatever personal life gains he's been able to make recently. On the other hand, someone like Evander Holyfield still makes a living of sorts from boxing and freak show matches. I need to get your opinion on the big Holyfield versus Francois Botha rematch, inexplicably scheduled for later this year.
Wow, I'll have to set the DVR for that one. You know, Holyfield, you know, talk about a guy that, you know, the ultimate overachiever, but, you know, the first lesson of Evander Holyfield is alimony and child support are proportional. That's all I got to say. If you're going to have 10-plus kids with a bunch of different women, you better be prepared to work double shifts. And,
yeah.
You know, that's what he's doing. I mean, it's really sad, too, because, you know, he's coming up on, I think, 50 here. And, you know, still fighting. And I guess, you know, fighting the Brian Nielsens of the world and the, you know, guys like Sherman Williams, and now and then he'll get a title shot against some belt holder. I guess that sort of reduces the danger a little bit, but he's still in there getting hit. And it's just, you know, just don't have a bunch of kids and a bunch of ex-wives. If I could implore any young potential millionaire athlete, just don't have a brood. You know, have one family and try and not get divorced. But I'm not an expert, so.
Jason, you're definitely one of the most well-respected MMA journalists at this stage. I think you've earned that through a combination of consistently interesting written work and your ability to mostly avoid the kind of white trash MMA media drama that seems to come around every few months. But seriously, yeah, do you have any thoughts on why you've been able to establish yourself as one of the least hated writers covering the sport? I mean, you could look at, I don't want to name websites, but I mean, I'm sure you're well aware of the certain sites out there that are just despised by everyone.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, having been a student of media and, you know, studied a lot in college, I mean, even though I ultimately became a political science major, I think the thing is there are no moats in today's media. You know, if you zoom back to 15, 20 years ago, there were definite hard concrete moats. But what I mean by that is people that wrote for publications and people that didn't. And with the prevalence and the emergence of media, particularly social media, you know, it's kind of everyone can get kind of in on the bandwagon. Anyone can start a website. Anyone can do everything. And while a lot of people are excited about that, sort of the democratization of media, you know, there is a qualitative effect. I mean, it is a bell curve. I mean, you have, you know, with the moat removed, everyone can become an expert on everything. So it's not really go and pick up the morning paper and see a byline. And if you want to interact with someone, if you don't like their article, you can write a letter to the editor. Now it's a blog post. I mean,
sure.
I've just sort of come to terms with the fact, which I'm sure you have well, is in today's fluid and dynamic media, you know, whether you share an article or, you know, a video segment or a radio program, you are putting it out there for people to say whatever they want about it, and there will always be sort of a certain portion of people that want to post negative things about whatever. And I think just to, you know, it's always been my thought that to engage that is really to kind of just sort of give those people more motivation to do it. And the sad thing is you do get in some good exchanges with people. I mean, I love, you know, I try and answer every reader email I ever get. But there really aren't a lot of, you know, sort of qualitative barriers to what is and isn't a journalist, particularly in something as you know, undercovered as MMA. I mean, I would always pull my hair out, as I'm sure you or any other fan and media person would. You know, a few years ago you'd see the quote-unquote mainstream publication, you know, do an article, maybe, you know, like when the New York Times covered Fedor or mm-hmm. whatever, and you kind of read through it and you know that this is a person that doesn't cover MMA, but there's always something you catch, you know, whether they call
yeah.
it. You know, a couple of days ago, the Sacramento Bee ran an article on the decline of boxing, and in the second paragraph, you know, the writer wrote something about boxing's losing its audience due to extreme ultimate fighting. You know? And I was like, that's so 1997. Like,
yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, it's worse than that. It's one thing for some guy who you know, is a newbie to the sport, covering the sport for a publication like the Sacramento Bee or for ESPN. But what we had in New York here with you know, the state legislators here up north in New York, they were using the same terminology, and they had the same ignorance as many of these people, these Johnny-come-latelys to the sport, have.
Really?
And because of this, I think that contributed to mixed martial arts not being legal, not getting sanctioned in New York, because the UFC put a lot of lobbying effort behind this. They spent a lot of money. There was huge grassroots campaigns. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of people – You know, we're trying to reach out to the legislature, and reach out to the citizens of New York, but it didn't get passed. And part of the reason why it didn't get passed was because of ignorance. So it's just even more frustrating when you hear, you know, politicians speaking like that, referring to it as human cockfighting, which is absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, I mean, we could have a whole other show discussion about this.
Yeah, no, and the sad thing is that it doesn't endure, you know, in all places like New York, which, you know, I'm sure prides itself on being sort of an aware metropolitan, you know, entity on the pulse of everything, you know, just kind of backward.
Who else do you admire in the MMA media or respect?
You know, some of the people, you know, I've been blessed to work with a lot of great people. You know, Josh Gross is an outstanding journalist. You know, always on top of the story, gets the fine details and really fleshes them out. I always know, you know, in the few occasions when I've known that he's working on a story that I'm working on, that I really need to bring my A game because he will get those details. Loretta Hunt, always a good, you know, investigative journalist, got a lot of news, broke a lot of big stories. You know, Ariel gets a lot of great interviews at the UFC. I mean, there's a lot of good breaking stuff that he gets, and I really admire him for his ability to really manage an interview and sort of, especially when there's tension in an interview, to kind of make it work for the betterment of the interview,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, that's really underrated quality that he has,
mm-hmm.
especially with the James Tonys and the Rampage Jacksons, you know? It's easy to interview kind of the cliche-spouting guy, but, you know, Ariel has a live one. He really manages it well, and that's kind of as fun for me to watch as the interview. And, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, formerly mainstream, you know, guys like Kevin Ioli. You know, I've known Kevin for years. We used to cover boxing matches together that have sort of given MMA the respect and the treatment that it deserves. So there's a lot of good folks out there, and there's a lot of good young talent. You know, I was just fortunate enough to come into MMA, you know, timing was right in the late 90s, early 2000s. I think when websites just needed somebody to want to cover MMA, you know, nobody really.
Yeah, I remember back then there was virtually, I mean, of course, the internet was around, but you didn't have the real dot-com boom. You didn't really have a large percentage of the American population that had the internet. You know, back in 2000, 2001, that's when the internet really, really started to take off. And back then, the only publication that I could remember, was a Full Contact Fighter, the magazine.
Great.
And they you know, they used to, I mean, you know, I used to know, one of the editors of there, of that, and one of the photographers. And back then, I mean, I'm sure that maybe Kevin Bennett was around, or Ryan Bennett, you know, maybe some of these other guys, but there was really nothing because just the sport had just not picked up. I mean, the sport wasn't even legal until in New Jersey until 2001,
yeah.
With you know, the unified rules, and so it just I remember going to Atlantic City and seeing the UFC fights and thinking to myself, wow, this is like so underground. I can't believe that people you know, really aren't aware of this. But
oh,
I want to kind of I want to ask you a question about the state of MMA, and then I want to go back to other MMA figures. Does it depress you at all, or from a journalistic standpoint, that the UFC, Zuffa, the parent company of the UFC, is basically in control of everything right now? They have a lock on 90% of the top 10 fighters, you know, and it's just it's very, very difficult for anyone that's critical of the UFC to get you know, to be allowed to cover any of their events. Do you think that the state of MMA is healthy right now?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's, you know, MMA is really emblematic of the free market. And when I say that, I mean, you know, who is willing to take risks and build a brand, build a business, and what lengths are they willing to go to defend what they perceive to be the integrity of that brand or control it down to the, you know, the fine points. I do like the two promoter model, you know, kind of the vintage Pride versus UFC days. But I have felt ambiguous about it because I saw what it did with boxing with the watering down of titles and going from, you know, three sanctioning bodies when they had the IBF in the mid-80s to four to the WBO when that became accepted in the mid-90s and God, now I think there's like an IBO that, you know, somebody sent me a press release on Antonio Tarver winning his fifth world title. He won the IBO by knocking out Danny Green. You know, so I know where that slippery slope leads. I think, you know, at the end of the day, Zuffa's going to do what they think is good for business. And ultimately, it's, you know, as always, it's up to the media really to do their job and report things accurately and factually and, you know, get both or more sides of the story. So whether or not it's healthy for MMA, I think they'd say it would be. People that have had issues with them, I think they say would not. You know, the interesting thing I'm really watching now is as MMA really takes it, and I think we are in a quantum leap, is once MMA gets to the point where mainstream sports journalists are covering it, my guess is having worked as a journalist at, you know, non-sporting publications for many years, I think that their approach to the media will have to change. A lot of MMA media have exclusively covered the sport, so they don't really know any better. But I think in terms of a crackdown on, you know, if they don't want to credential people, they don't want to credential people. But,
right.
You know, but they can do that for now. But when they do it to, you know, say a writer from, you know, the LA Times or, you know, major writers that have, you know, been critical of other sports studies and didn't, you know, get uncredentialed, I think that's when they run into a problem.
What about people you don't respect or enjoy reading so much that are still considered relevant? Some people find Jordan Breen basically doing a pro wrestling website character a bit off-putting, but he still definitely tries to analyze fights while having his own niche, so to speak. Someone like Tomas Rios is a bit more clearly controversial since he would bait and basically insult fighters, which I guess is a gimmick in a way, but also did it worth, you know he's offers predictions, he offers his analysis, he tries to be a journalist, he just has a different style about him. Do you have any thoughts on any of those, or is there anybody in particular that you don't like reading or don't like listening to?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us do. I mean, I'm sure I'm on somebody's list or many people's list, so I probably wouldn't name anybody. I mean, first off,
sure.
My thoughts, and as it is qualified, I mean, I work with Jordan at SureDog, so... but I would say that anybody that doesn't like Jordan Breen basically doesn't have above an eighth grade reading level. I mean, if you don't understand sense of humor, irony, and sort of a polysyllabic approach to explaining the base business of fights, then that's your right. But the guy has forgotten more about fights than 99.9% of us will ever know. I mean, he's unbelievably knowledgeable. And as someone who's, you know, made the craft of writing basically my living, he's a phenomenal writer, even though he rarely does write. He's a naturally gifted radio host. He's just a phenomenally gifted individual. So I don't even understand why anybody wouldn't like him, but hey, it's a free country.
Yeah.
I mean, and I understand, I mean, people, you know, don't like a certain approach or whatever. That's fine. I used to see it a lot in boxing. You know, I think one of the benefits of sort of MMA going mainstream is that sites have the ability to pay people. You know, back when it was all kind of free, I think even some of the major sites really suffered from kind of the, you know, the weak byline syndrome. You know, you see somebody's byline and you're like, oh God, this is going to rub me the wrong way. And there's less and less of that, you know. And we saw it all a lot, especially in the early, mid-2000s when you see these MMA correspondents that, they're just folks that didn't know what they didn't know to a certain extent because no one had told them. I mean, they didn't know the difference between hard news, you know, and a feature, breaking news or maybe an opinion piece. And I think on the web, you know, it can be tempting to kind of vacillate between those. And it takes a certain amount of skill to sort of, you know, use different literary forms. I mean, you know, if you're really applying for or trying for the sort of the high-end New Yorker, you know, type of piece in MMA, that can be very hard to do. But if you have the chops to pull it off, more power to you. But, you know, I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, sites are going to pay for people that do better work, and the people that don't, you know, won't get those jobs. And sometimes they do have them. I mean, and also writing is a case of triage. I mean, you know, when, you know, I turn out, on some weeks I'll turn out 3 or 4 or 5, 6 articles, and, you know, when I'm sitting there on a deadline, you know, and I've got 1,000 words to pump out on a fighter after I've written 2 or 3 post-event stories and a preview, you know, I'd like to be on my A game, but I'm not. You know, I'm like a marathoner that hit the 20-mile mark. I'm just trying to finish. I'm not going to break any pace records. So I think that's another thing too. And in this world of, you know, online comments and stuff, everyone thinks that they're a respected critic, and so they can voice their two cents while they, you know, they've never made a deadline in their life. You know, it's why, and it's also why I'm very I try not to personally criticize fighters. I mean,
sure,
having trained, you know, just enough MMA, you know, to know how difficult it is, and boxed a little bit, and you know, had my head and limbs handed to me on the mat. You know, I know what it's like to be dead tired with someone on top of me that's a lot better than me. You know, to mm-hmm. feel that feeling of, wow, I'm getting my ass handed to me. That's why, you know, with kind of when I write fight previews and stuff, I try not to delve into the personal, because it's really unnecessary. And
that's,
you know,
right.
I haven't walked in that fighter's shoes, and I haven't done anything remotely close to what they've done. So it is a fine line between, you know, saying, hey, fighter A has this advantage over B, and being able to express that in a way that, you know, doesn't, you know, necessarily delve into personal attacks. But you'd be surprised. As you know, I mean, fighters are some of the most sensitive people you'll ever meet. They're very sensitive to slight criticism. You wouldn't know, but many of them are.
That's right. And many of them read the forums. A lot of people that I've interviewed are very active on the forums, and some fighters are just tired of the garbage that we see on the forums.
Yeah.
You know, and I totally understand that. I mean, one of the things I like about mixed martial arts is that the media is online. The nucleus of the MMA media is online. Everything is online. Promoters are online. Fans are online. You know, the highest officials at Zuffa, they pay attention to what's going online. I mean, if it wasn't for online, there would be no Carson's Corner. There'd be no me, you know.
Yeah.
And you know what? I took the approach when I started in 2005. I took the approach that you were sort of describing before, insulting fighters. I insulted, you know, a lot of fighters said some terrible things about fighters, and people naturally reacted. And I learned my lesson from that. I mean, I'm still very opinionated. I still will call out, or I still will insult the fighter, but I'm not a shock jock anymore. I have opinions, my intent is not to piss off as many fighters as I possibly can and hope that I'm going to get some sort of publicity. That's not the way it works. You got to offer people a product, and people will cut right through that. If you're just out there to insult people, there's one guy in particular that does this, and I'm not going to mention the names, but there's a guy who has a shtick, and all he does is insult people and challenge people. You're not gonna really further yourself by doing that. You can have opinions. Everybody has opinions. I'm very, very strong and opinionated on certain different things. There are certain fighters I don't like, but my intent, I have a good intent. My intent is not to bring a fighter down. And I think people will realize that if you come at it with something along those lines.
Well, yeah. And see, my thing was, is, you know what, when I started covering boxing in the, you know, 97, I started going to fights starting 98 or 99, you know, I had a very different thing, is that, you know, I was never really tempted to kind of, you know, do the trolling, insult fighters, because I was running into these fighters, you know, fighters,
sure,
and knew their managers. So, you know, while it might have been funny to sort of make fun of the Klitschkos for one of the early knockout losses, I also knew that I'd run into them and their manager Bernd Bonte in Vegas, you know, about between them about 14 feet tall. You know, so that adds sort of a different flavor to it. And I've always said, as, you know, somebody who's kind of covered politics and crime in my other, you know, writing outlets, you know, the only kind of really 100% honest journalism is reporting on people you'll never see or hear from again.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are offended by that, but it's more or less, it's the truth. I mean, you've kind of got to have a thick skin to do it, but if you don't have to deal with the people you're, you know, writing about, you know, on a daily basis, I mean, I guess it's easy to kind of, you know, take that angle. But it never interested me. I was always kind of more interested in getting the nuts and bolts of the story.
I want to thank Jace again quickly here for being on the show. I knew that he came at a very convenient time for himself, and he's one of these MMA analysts that I really, really respect. Like I said during the discussion, Jace is one of the few respected members of the MMA media, and for good reason. He's consistent. He doesn't self-destruct in public, trying to make a name for himself that his analytic abilities can't do. Tomas Rios is cut from a different cloth. Well, you know. We talked about that. And you know what? I mean, he's a true professional, Jason. He really is. And I was really surprised to learn that he is an observer of Dan Quinn's videos. You know, that's pretty remarkable. Tonight we've got boxing. We've got Amir Khan versus Zab Judah. In the MMA world right now, we have Bellator featuring Zach Jansen versus Neil Grove. And the next round of their tournament for fighters at 145 pounds. And as I mentioned, we have the Zab Judah versus Amir Khan fight. If Khan can dispatch of Judah impressively, he should create an opportunity for more big paydays in the United States. Fans tend to either love or hate Khan, so if he can establish himself as a threat in his division, I can see him getting in there with some of the big names, okay? If he doesn't take out Judah, then I think he might be hitting a plateau as a fighter. He improved a lot under Freddie Roach, but a bit like Manny Pacquiao, he improved. But it seems that quick KO victories are now a bit more elusive for him. Part of me expects Khan to come out and easily control the fight, maybe with one or two slight scares, and then he'll put on a decent but not electrifying performance. With Khan's more attrition-based punching style and Judah having a decent amount of heart, this could potentially get ugly. We'll see what happens, though. You know, Zab is a southpaw. He has pretty good power early on and is working with Pernell Whitaker, one of the best southpaws ever, so he could prove to be elusive in this fight. We'll cover the result of Khan versus Judah and Bellator on a show in the near future if there's anything notable to report, folks. We've had some communication from UK fans having problems ordering that show, by the way. Keep us posted if you can get the fight or not, and we'll look into it if there's any problems. Could Rupert Murdoch and his crew of elite phone voicemail hackers be to blame for this right now? Actually, I'm laughing, but those people who hacked the personal correspondence of private citizens, some of them deceased, need to be brought to justice. Like James Murdoch over there. He got busted for lying about making hush money payments. He went in front of the parliament in the UK and just flat out lied about it, according to some. What a bunch of scumbags. These people are just scumbags. They really are. And they need to be investigated, and they are being investigated here in the United States. It's good to see the Justice Department do that, but you know what? If they find something, if the Justice Department finds something on Rupert Murdoch, are they going to have the will to prosecute? Because Rupert Murdoch is a billionaire. He owns the Republican Party, and he's got a lot of power, and the Obama administration seems to not want to fight with anyone except their own base. Just my opinion. All right, that's it for this week's show. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. If you want to friend me on Facebook, just type in Bob Carson. You'll see my profile. And if you like politics, you may like my political show. It's on Underground Progressive Radio Saturday and Sunday at undergroundprogressiveradio.webs.com. We're on a station here in Brick. And you can catch all of my archives at bobcarson13.podomatic.com. That is bobcarson13.podomatic.com. Until next time, folks, show some respect.